What? That's the sound of a rattlesnake in your earbuds. That's right, if you didn't want the stone cold Steve Austin experience, you need to shut them earbuds off right now. As a matter of fact, why don't you just take them ears and rip them off? Because if you don't want stone cold talking to you, then you don't deserve ears. Can I get a hell yeah? I'm gonna go ahead and assume you said it. I'm here today because I want to tell you about my friends over at 10 Bell Pod. 10 Bell Pod, Tyler Wood, Nick Alexander, and Jake, the Man Scout Man, and bringing you some of the best wrestling content on the internet. Now, can I get a hell yeah? While you're giving me a hell yeah, why don't you go ahead and pop over to their Patreon? Go ahead and give a subscription. Then why don't you hop your fat little ass right over to Pro Wrestling Tees and get a 10 Bell Pod exclusive t-shirt featuring all three of these beautiful men. You might be saying, what? What? Stone Cold, you think these men are beautiful? God damn it, I do. Now you get over there and you buy that t-shirt before I stomp a mud hole in you and walk it dry. Now let me get a hell yeah.
If you want my favorite kayfabe story is when we would wrestle at the Mooresville Armory with Bobby Fulton. Mostly George South ran the shows, but one time Bobby Fulton was on the show, and that's when he's doing his Sheik of Araby thing, because he's like, I love the Sheik. The Sheik was, was very good to me when I was young, because Bobby Fulton's a fucking weirdo, and he's like, hey, as a six-year-old man, I want to start doing a Sheik gimmick, but I'm just some white dude from Ohio, so I'll put a mask on and put a sword on the side of it and come out with the sword. And we were in the locker room, which was just basically an office. It had like the blinds that you kind of turn, like just normal like window blinds, and they were just open like ever so slightly. And Bobby Fulton went out and did his fucking Sheik gimmick with the prayer rug and everything like that, because that's not cultural appropriation. It's super racist. He gets to the back, he takes the mask off, and he notices the blinds are just slightly ajar. And he flips out and be like, kayfabe! And like shuts the lights off in the locker room. And it is pitch black in there. And like, you can't see. And he goes, we got a kayfabe, guys, got a kayfabe! The windows are open. And keep in mind, there is nobody outside. There isn't a fucking person outside. Nobody can see in. But he like shuts the lights off and refuses to let anybody turn the lights on. So for the rest of the night, everybody's like going over the matches, putting their gear on in fucking darkness, because fucking Bobby Fulton with a fucking sword is in the back, like protecting kayfabe.
Hello and welcome to this episode of 10 Bell Pod. I am Nick Alexander and I trust no one after covering this. I am joined by a guy who exposes our podcast with spot monkey jokes, Tyler Wood.
Thank you, Nick.
We are, of course, joined by a liar, liar, pants on campfire, professional fibber, the man scout Jake Manning, if that's even your real name.
It's definitely not, actually. It's actually Jake Feuerbach. It's funny that we're discussing kayfabe today because I have gotten many a checks that are addressed to Jake Manning.
Oh, yeah. Is that hard to deal with?
It's happened more than a few times, and I'd be like, my real last name is not Manning. Do you guys not know what a gimmick is at all? Like, you're the promoter. You should know. They're like, Manning's not your real name? Yeah. Do you want to pronounce Feuerbach? And also, too, alliteration, fools. Yeah. Man Scout Manning. Fucking works.
Today, we have kind of a curveball of an episode, if not an outright true crime episode, because today we're discussing the murder of kayfabe. Let me start by saying that kids that somehow stumbled across this, first off, we say fuck way too much for you to be here, or someone who knows wrestling is 100% real, you are entirely correct and are excluded from this episode and this discussion on all points. Stop the show. Live in that for a while and keep this as fun as you can for as long as you can. Because I promise you, the real reason wrestling fans are always so angry is because we have been chasing that dragon that you're currently riding, and we never get sweet release except for like maybe once every few years when the perfect angle comes together. Now, for us bitter, jaded assholes, first off, we can't possibly get into every single time kayfabe has been broken or exposed, because for an industry that's supposed to protect it at all costs, good God, you have not. My event is a bullet point on our timeline, but I wanted to ask you two, how old were you? What was the thing? When was the moment that you learned pro wrestling wasn't real and the spirit of kayfabe left your body?
So I started watching in 2003. I know every time. So I came in at a time where kayfabe wasn't even, it was long dead at this point. Nobody thought it was real. I think as soon as I started watching, everybody in my family was like, hey, that's not real. Everybody that went to school was like, hey, that's not real. And I actually had the opposite reaction where I had times where I was like, yeah, it's fake, but that thing was real, right? It was like the little points in it. And
you still do it with me. You still do it with me. That guy was really mad. I think you just did it last time I got you free tickets to AEW. Like, oh, when Brody King hit him, that was real. Oh, I know that was. You still do it.
Yeah, it's part of the fun. That was my whole thing.
Oh, my. Yeah. That was your whole thing? Yeah. Okay, I ruined it? All right,
no,
cool.
No, you didn't ruin it. Wrestling was ruined for me when I started watching it.
And when you met me, pretty much I helped ruin that for you. Confirmed, yes.
That's, yeah, everything. You're on one of my bullet points.
For me, I don't know what the moment was for me. I mean, obviously, I had an uncle that wanted to ruin everything good that I liked in my life.
So it runs in the family.
Pretty much. I mean, this is why I am the way I am. All I wanted to do was just watch wrestling. And anytime he was around and I was watching wrestling at grandma's house, he'd be like, you know, that shit's fake. All this is fake and stupid. And he would just sit there and say it over and over. It's fake. You know, it's fucking stupid. This is fake. This is fake, 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 fake.
Jeez.
Like, he was deliberate. And when I first got into professional wrestling and started working at high spots and making money off of it and owning a house and paying my bills with professional wrestling, my uncle told me, it's like, nah, you really need to get out of this professional wrestling business. Know what you need to start doing is filming high school sports. That's where the money is. And he had all this career advice for me, and it had multiple times telling me to get out of professional wrestling and tell me how successful he was in the Detroit motor industry. And then all of a sudden, Tyler's laughing because he knows where I'm going. Because he lost his job, because Detroit fell apart, because he was doing this like kind of in the mid 80s, late 80s and 90s. And I will never forget, I think it was my sister's wedding, after he'd lost his job and basically was coaching high school sports, you know, that multi-million-dollar industry he told me to get into. And here I am paying my bills with professional wrestling. And he looked right at me and goes, you were right all along. I can't tell you how fucking satisfying it is. So much to know that I rub it in his face that way. But for me, as far as pro wrestling, I always defended it as a kid, but I don't remember what the specific incident was. Probably it was my uncle telling me over and over again. Some level I always kind of knew. And as a pro wrestler over the years, I can't tell you how many times when I tell people that I'm involved with professional wrestling that I hear people's breaking of kayfabe moment. The second that I mention that I'm a pro wrestler, they have to tell me, let me tell you when I stop believing in wrestling. Like, we just want to go about our day, get to the next town, make some money, entertain people that like what we do. But we have to hear from people that want to tell us that what we're doing is bullshit. And the moment they realized it. But me, I always kind of knew at some level. And I loved it enough to be in professional wrestling even 20 years later. So get over it. It's dead. Who gives a fuck? Let's talk about it.
Obviously not to that extent, Jake, but as a wrestling fan, I do get a little bit of that from time to time where people come up to me and they're like, I used to think it was real until X, Y, or Z. And my favorite is when they will go, well, it's not real like it was back in the 90s, the 80s, the 60s. And I'm like, it's been fucking fake the whole time.
Yeah, you mean to the new generation era?
In professional wrestling, kayfabe is the portrayal of staged events within the industry as real or true, specifically the portrayal of competition, rivalries, and relationships as being genuine and not staged. kayfabe and shoot have kind of, with the internet, morphed into fiction, nonfiction, even though passing off things as shoot to dirt sheets and the internet and booking genuinely unlikable human beings as hills is kind of the new form of kayfabe. We won't get into that. For this episode, we're going to stick to the word kayfabe because pro wrestling is anything but fake. Ask any wrestler about the effect of CTE on their daily lives, their surgeries, their backs, their knees, their hips. We won't even touch on the emotional damage from the mix of working in a frat boy house in the entertainment industry.
Or getting stabbed, we'll talk about a little bit later, and showing scars. I feel like I'm not a wrestler because I didn't get 70 stitches down my back for getting stabbed after wrestling one time in Richmond, Virginia.
Us modern wrestling fans are very guilty of labeling anyone before the Attitude Era as just a clueless, real to me, damn it, Mark, who believed this shit was 100% real. But I'm sorry to say, most people have known this shit is scripted, predetermined, whatever word makes you feel the best, for easily 100 years now. Now, you have people who lived for a while without ever hearing it or connecting the dots. Most of these people are probably like from the 70s, 80s. And that's due to the dedication of the wrestlers. You have people from regions. Deductive reasoning isn't their forte. And while the legitimacy of wrestling had certainly been questioned prior, we will start in the 1920s with the Gold Dust Trio and something we touched on in our Gorgeous George episode. The moment these unhinged spot monkeys added punching to the moveset, the jig was up. So in the 20s, you have people who fought in World War I, the Spanish-American War, if not the Civil War. As we get into the 30s and 40s, World War II, at the popularity of boxing, these people have punched, been punched, and have seen punching. While wrestling did use strikes sparingly at first, getting blasted wide open, unprotected to the face, even like five times, with open-handed strikes even, hell, especially with palm strikes, your eyes swell, your teeth get knocked out, you bust lips, you break noses. And I think people underestimate how often you break your hand in a fight without wraps, tapes, and gloves.
But at the same time, too, with everything that gets evolved in professional wrestling, it becomes more exciting. Especially when you have a, as we've discussed before, like the barnstorming era of taking somebody who's absolutely hated and finally getting your hands on this asshole and punching him right in the face. That's what you want to see in this particular art form is the bad guy get beat up, and a bad guy punching a guy while he's down makes him that much more of a bad guy. It just, in the same sense that 450s and spectacular dives and 630s and everything else that's thrown out there makes professional wrestling more spectacular, punches did the same in the 20s. It just made it much more spectacular and, you know, fulfilled what people wanted to see in professional wrestling.
Even with something as simple as a punch, there's always been this trade-off of spectacle and believability. So like a punch makes the match more exciting, but it's like, this guy just got put in the turnbuckles by a 300-pounder and walloped 10 times as the crowd counted, and he's fine.
Let's not even get into the Irish whip.
Even with that, the fervor that the wrestlers had for keeping kayfabe alive was enough to keep a good bit of people believing or at least questioning it. But the 1930s especially put kayfabe on hard times. And it starts with Jack Pfeffer, a man that would look at every evil thing Vince McMahon has ever done and say, "I remember when men were men, pussy."
You can't even say the P word, like, just, that's just weird. The weird pronunciation that should not be just glazed over in the middle of this episode, okay?
Pfeffer was a promoter of the era, mostly in the New York scene, although he traveled around a bit. He was famous for all the underhanded shitbag promoter stuff we all know and love, but he had a deep love for hack ripoff gimmicks. He'd just call someone Frank Gooch or Greg Hackenschmidt, Gorgeous Jim. In fact, Buddy Rogers started as a knockoff Gorgeous George before splitting from Pfeffer. Pfeffer had a big falling out with Jack Curley and a collection of primarily Northeast promoters that basically squeezed him out of the business. And from everything I've learned about him, he probably deserved it. But this bitch, this little bitch, ran straight to the New York Daily Mirror or the New York Times, I've heard it both ways, and sang like Takeshi 6ix9ine. This prompted a series of articles from December 1933 throughout 34 exposing pro wrestling as a work way before Nick and Mac Jackson could do it with super kicks.
Be careful. Be careful what you say. Careful. You've been warned. You've been warned. I don't think this will be the last Young Buck reference in this episode. Be warned, there are consequences to your actions okay. and your words.
Nick, can you start slapping your leg every time you tell a punchline?
Fuck yourself! Go fuck yourself! Go fuck yourself.
While these were most certainly not the first time newspaper articles that questioned the validity of wrestling, this gave the Marks a bite of the apple of the tree of good brother knowledge, and it gave the doubters, who in all fairness were 100% correct, all the ammo they needed so that their great-great-great-grandkid could get on Instagram and go, yeah, you know it's fake, right?
But who gives a shit at the end of the fucking day? I'm surprised it's taken us now almost 15 minutes for me to just say, who gives a fuck? Like, it's fucking cool. It's fun. It's simulated combat, much like every movie you see, except these guys are doing it in reaction to how the crowd is reacting, which, you know, Tom Cruise months down the road will do a fight scene for Mission Impossible, and he'll do it and he'll be like, well, I think we make it look good, and then they mess around in editing and they take some time and they screen in front of an audience and they say, oh, this action sequence was too short, too long, or I liked it, or I didn't like it. And then they make more changes, and then they release it. This shit's happening live. Live combat simulated to reaction of a crowd and doing more or less and feeding off an atmosphere is amazing. I don't give a fuck. I hope they're working together. And guess what? When they work together, shit turns out really cool. Because when you have a guy that's uncooperative or doesn't know what he's fucking doing, it looks fucking terrible. But when you have guys working together really well, this shit is fucking awesome and it's pro wrestling.
If there's like an all-encompassing theme to this episode, it's that wrestling fans don't care that it's fake. Weirdly enough, Jack Pfeffer was not immediately murdered. He actually even got back into the business in 37 and had a long career as an outlaw scumbag promoter.
Which is funny because I think, I don't know if it's about this time or not, maybe a few years later, the mafia is involved with professional wrestling because it's a good way to launder money. So trying to expose something that the mafia is involved with at the time, you can be a scumbag, but you can also have balls. But of course, kind of if you're a scumbag, you got to have balls.
So this is obviously the 30s. News didn't travel even like it would in 10 years from the 30s. So while the Northeast could have been smartened up a bit, the rest of the country could still believe depending on where and how quickly the news traveled. It was but a flesh wound to kayfabe, and there's a debate whether this even hurt the business at all. More likely contributing factors to the dip in wrestling around this time was the Depression, the war, and we're only like a decade or so away from Gorgeous George and TV, taking wrestling into the golden era, arguably the best era ever, but this did prompt a few negative things. An investigation of all major promotions, including Jack Curley, by the New York State Athletic Commission over fixing matches, so you either have people also having to expose it to the commission or lying and risking losing their business. And it led to perhaps kayfabe's greatest nemesis besides skinny guys doing backflips, 1937's book The Fall Guys by sports writer Marcus Griffin, which I have started reading like 5 times and never finished. It is a tough read. Like, lots of good info, but it sucks.
That's me trying to watch any match before the 80s.
Go fuck yourself. Entertainment's just, it's different. Like, you watch movies from that time, it's not good. And books are kind of, not all books are great, especially an expose about something that's brand new. But I've heard about this book before. It's always held up as like, you know, see, like, we've been exposing it for years.
So originally published in 37, this well-researched book exposed wrestling as a cutthroat business with shady promoters and, most importantly, the fixed nature of the business while focusing in on the Gold Dust Trio. So the fact that people were doing like hard-hitting journalism stories in the 80s and 90s is hilarious. The people in the 30s that thought a lobotomy cured period cramps or whatever the fuck, they figured it out. So what are you doing? Getting into the 40s, it looked like this generation, unless you guys found something, it looked like this generation of wrestlers kept things pretty snug, or at least kept the spirit and the illusion of kayfabe alive. Like, in theory, Pfeffer and the Fall Guys should have drugged down the entire industry, but somehow kayfabe managed to survive, or at least the willingness of fans to suspend belief survived. As we roll into the 40s and 50s, the business was printing money, so everyone involved had like an incentive to keep the work working.
I remember my grandmother talking to me when I first got into wrestling. She was like, I know wrestling. And like, she always discussed, like, I always knew it's fake or predetermined or whatever word you want to use for it. And she described it as such. She's like, oh, it was fun. I'd turn it on every once in a while. And my dad is kind of the same way. It was stuff he saw back in the 60s. And he's like, it was cool. Like, those guys were wild men. You had to like stop from changing the channel when you would see these people on TV because they were insane. And they're talking directly into a TV camera. I mean, you go back to the Mongolian Stomper threatening to pile drive Helen Hart on the driveway of the Hart House. Like, who doesn't want to just stop and just watch this man talk for a little while? And a lot of the TV matches are very short, and their job guys were stars are kind of taking liberties with guys, and you're not letting them wrestle for very long to, you know, expose it that much on television because you want them to go to the arena, and then you know, you're buying a ticket and you're in the upper deck, so you're not right up in front and you're not seeing how close or how far they're hitting each other. So yeah, you can suspend disbelief and it can be a bit more hidden to you because you're not watching hour-long matches and detailing all the holes that you see. Like, rarely do you see a whole heck of a lot of wrestling happening on television. It's these crazy men talking into a microphone, which is captivating.
Jake, come on. You can smarten us up. We're friends here. That's not your real grandma, is it? That's a stunt grain.
So in the 1960s, the face of pro wrestling was Bruno Sammartino, and the face of pro wrestling in the 70s was Harley Race. You gonna tell either one of them that this shit is fake, or do you want to live to see tomorrow? And I think you could argue that this bridge between the golden era and the rock and roll era is the strongest kayfabe ever was. You know, it was a new crop of kids growing up with a industry that was a little more tight-lipped than the fucking 30s, but it definitely wasn't perfect. While I couldn't really find a big event like a curtain call or an expose from the 50s or 60s, there's these newspaper articles that I'll hopefully remember to post when we release this. It's basically a Q&A asking non-wrestling fans and wrestling fans if they believe wrestling is a work, and overwhelmingly, yes. They were like, we're rational people with fucking eyeballs. We understand that it's scripted. It's literally the same argument someone's having on Facebook right now. Print it in a 60s newspaper. The mix of it's fake, so it's stupid, versus pain is real, it's so it's scripted, it's not fake, so either watch it for the drama and spectacle or go watch a TV show, which is also scripted. It's always been this argument.
Well, and also they're TV stars. They're a bit more catered to. Things can be hit a bit more. There wasn't this whole gotcha media thing or gotcha this. I mean, this is the time where Mickey Mantle is doing all kinds of deplorable things all over the city of New York with reporters around everywhere. And like, ooh, I don't want to put this bad story of Mickey Mantle getting drunk at a nightclub and doing all these salacious things. I can't put that in a newspaper. I got to protect Mickey Mantle. He's a Yankee. In much in the same sense, like Bruno Sammartino selling out Madison Square Garden. Do I really want to go up to him and belittle him or make him feel bad when he's out there selling tickets and being this role model for the people? That's kind of what the vibe was, where it's the complete opposite today. Or like, oh, these are celebrities. They're basically tools and vehicles for us to make memes out of.
So my grandpa, bring him up a lot on this podcast, I had a very strong relationship with him, and a lot of it was based around us watching wrestling. And one of his favorite stories to tell me was when he was trucking down in Georgia. Used to drive a dump truck from North Carolina down to Georgia a few times a week, and he would always stop and check out some Georgia Championship Wrestling when he was in town, when it lined up. And he told me that one time after a show, he went to a bar with some buddies he was drinking, and they ran into none other than Sputnik Monroe. And my grandpa, he was full of shit, is the best way that I can put it. He was a great storyteller and a great sense of humor, but you were never quite sure if exactly what he was saying was true. But an odd person to pick, Sputnik Monroe. I don't know why you would pick somebody not quite at the top of the card if you're going to tell a tall story. So I think that gives some validity to it. And he said that, I think this is probably during the height of Sputnik in that territory, just getting a drink with him. My grandpa told me that Sputnik said, yeah, this is not real. when we bleed and he takes something out of his pocket and it's a blood pill, something that's filled with red liquid, and they smash it on their head and makes it look like they're bleeding. He's like, this is how we bleed. Now, obviously, the hindsight of 50, 60 years in between, we know that there was a combination of that, bleeding, and whatever to make somebody bleed. But I like that was my grandpa knew in the 70s, and he still continued to watch it all the way up until he died in 2021. And he enjoyed it either way, even though Sputnik Monroe, one of the scariest motherfuckers of the time, told him, like, nah, this shit's not real, man.
Or Sputnik was fucking with your grandpa when he's like, no, I take a razor blade right to my head, but I'm not going to tell you that. I'm going to tell you a bigger lie to make you sound stupider when you say it.
It's UFO much conspiracy shit, man. It's disinformation.
Yeah, like exactly. Something that George South used to do all the time when he'd be doing all these fair shows, and it's the most amazing Jedi mind trick you'll ever see before in your entire life. You know, you're wrestling at a fair, so your casual person's going to walk by, like somebody that doesn't like professional wrestling at all, or is aware of it, or whatever, or doesn't give a fuck about it. And it was at a fair show one time. This person walked up and asked, is this wrestling fake? Right away to George South, a man who has paid his bills with professional wrestling for years. And you'd think, like, oh, George would just bow up and get angry about it. And George was like, yep, it's all fake. Every bit of it. And then the guy started to go, whoa, what the punches? One guy was punching him, looked like he was laying in his face. George's like, oh, no, the punches are the most fake part of them all. you have to be a moron to believe any of this is real. It's all fake. It's all fake, 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 fake. And then the guy kept arguing with George. Finally, it ended up into a heated argument where the guy was defending professional wrestling to George on the validity of it. And he's like, no, I saw that guy slam him. That was real. Onto the ring. And George's like, nope, that thing's spring loaded. Nothing hurts at all when you land on that thing. And this guy like ended up just saying, fine, you can believe what you want, but I know that pro wrestling's real. And that guy walked away. And I go to George, I'm like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen before in my life. And George's like, oh, he just wants to argue with you. I just want him to get on my side. It's this weird mental jujitsu of just bringing this guy in that this guy ended up having a screaming match with George, telling him that pro wrestling is real.
Well, something that is very real in this industry is the history of wrestlers being greedy assholes. That takes us to 1979's Plan B Shoot. Technically, this didn't damage kayfabe because it was never circulated to the public, but people had to have seen it because it survives to this day.
I have always heard about this, but you sent me a link of it, and this is the first time I've ever seen it.
Oh, really? Oh,
yes, I've heard about this. I remember us doing an interview with Ronnie Garvin about it. Basically, if I'm not mistaken, it was about, wasn't it the Poffos had not paid all of these wrestlers?
That would have been an actual noble reason. It's much worse than that. So it was Ron Fuller's territory.
Okay, the Fullers.
He was apparently skimming money off the top of the house for Southeastern out of Knoxville. And there was like this big uprising. Although almost everyone agrees that Ron's territory paid the best. Like it was the ideal wrestling promotion to work in. And wrestlers were still CM Brooksing all over the place. This led to Bob Roop, who was hoping to kill Fuller's territory and business to start his own, doing like a mini exodus. It was Roop, Boris Malenko, Ron Garvin, Bob Orton, and Ron Wright. And they had this list of demands, and in their back pocket was this tape exposing the business. And had they released this video, the consequences would have been almost everyone going, we fucking know. No one cares, Bob Roop.
No, fuck that. This tape is amazing even to this day. We need to spend some time unpacking this fucking thing. Yes, it makes a lot more sense in Ron Fuller's territory. I'm getting it confused because Ronnie Garvin also got stiffed on payoffs from Angelo Poffo, which Italian Stallion had to go collect the money for that. So that's why I'm getting that confused. That's a completely different story as well, too. Maybe a Patreon episode. But typical pro wrestlers, like they see a full house and they're like, oh, we made $1 million, when actuality, we only made $150,000. People talk about promoter math being bad. Wrestler math is fucking three times worse. Like that whole comment of like, it's a $1 billion industry, but only $300 million reported to taxes, and you don't want the IRS sniffing around. So yeah, that's what like wrestlers like do. Trust me, I fucking know that because I have to talk to wrestlers on royalty agreements and doing almost everything but go through the math with them. And then explain to some wrestlers, like, you sold 12 shirts this month. you are not owed $2,000 on your royalty check. Like, trying to make that explanation, and you show them the report of them selling 12 shirts, and then they say our report is wrong when it's actually just a database, and you invite them if you want to go through every one of the single orders, or do you want to trust the search queue that goes through all the orders? Do you understand, like, how much work we'd have to do to fake an entirely different admin page? Like, I don't have that much time to cheat you out of the royalties that you're owed. So, yeah, just wrestlers can get very funny. And I'm guessing that's probably what happened here, is they're like, well, we're selling out every night and our pay isn't going up, or it only went up $10. You know, we should be making more. When really, like, you know, this is what you agreed upon. This is what you're supposed to be getting. And this is what it is. And wrestlers sometimes just can't see that. But yeah, I was always told that they were doing this to an extent that they weren't getting paid at all. And they used this to burn everything down, which I kind of admire a little bit. I thought about burning this entire wrestling business down a lot sooner than 10 years into the business, like some of them. Also, too, Bob Roop, not the most exciting person to start off on this tape.
Yeah,
like, it was tough to get through it, but the Great Malenko was pretty good.
Yeah,
but then,
yeah,
like,
it's my favorite.
They should have led with Ronnie Garvin. Him explaining that pro wrestling's not real, the way he did it, I'm like, I'm still on board. I'm still cool. And then, like, every one of them is like, they admit that wrestling is predetermined, but they have to show, well, I was stabbed by a fan. Like, I have to show that there's some danger to this, even though I'm taking away all of my sense of being a badass. Like, I have to come back. Like, you know, like somebody, they feel a little bit demasculated, so they come back even harder.
Yeah.
Like, overcompensate a little bit and show that they were stabbed. Also, too, it's funny. The Great Malenko, when he showed his scar, in that same instance where he got stabbed during that same incident with a fan, Bob Orton Sr. got hit in the head with a baseball bat.
Jesus
Christ.
And supposedly he was never the same after that, which, believe it.
Yeah.
But of course, I'm sure Bill Watts is like, how could you let a fan stab you? Did you kick his ass? You know, you let a fan stab you and leave a mark on you? I hope that fan is dead. Like, that's how Bill Watts' response would be. But this video was a trip, man, especially towards the end. Like, bringing in the IRS, and then like, we're going to talk about male prostitution. Jesus Christ. Like, this is wild. This whole thing. Go search it out. 1979 Plan B shoot. Gotta go find it. Gotta go watch. You can skip over Bob Roop's entrance and get right into the Great Malenko and then everything else. But man, this is a trip and a fucking half, especially like the very end statement of Bob Roop and all the things they're going to talk about. I wish they would do a series. I want to see the rest of this. There's so much to unpack with this thing. I don't know what you guys thought, but I mean, these were just my thoughts after just watching it.
I haven't seen it yet, but you said they brought in the IRS. What was Erwin R. Schreist? Fuck. What was Erwin R. Fucking goddamn it.
Scheiss.
Never
no,
mind.
No, we'll wait till
never
you get the joke.
Mind.
No, we'll wait. We'll wait till you get this joke right.
Never.
Because it's so goddamn funny.
You know what?
What did Charles say? And then the Undertaker came in and they stood next to each other and they were death and taxes. Because those two things you can't cheat. Why don't you go ahead and put that joke in there too? Why don't you do that? Come on, little comic. You can do it.
No, I was taught the best way to take a rib is not to sell it, right, Jake? So I'm just going to...
Nick, what was your thoughts on it? Like, just crazy? Like,
it's just nuts. The first time I ever saw this, I still kind of had the belief that the people from the 70s and 80s, kayfabe was still very serious to them. So the fact that they did this blew my mind, because this, especially in the South, where they really took kayfabe serious, it was one of the most shocking things. It's crazy they were going to do a series. It's truly just unhinged for, what was it, like 40 minutes?
Yeah, 20 minutes or so.
20 minutes.
And you know what? Right away, I should have known it was the Knoxville territory, because they brought out Ron Wright. And Ron Wright, I've talked about many times about who's the most over territorial babyface. And I always put Scott Casey as number 1 through 5. Most over regional heel ever, Ron fucking Wright.
All right, let's get into something that was not only actually released to the public, but on a very large scale. The 1984-2020 expose where John Stossel fucked around and found out. Disgruntled ex-wrestlers Eddie Mansfield and Jim Wilson did their best Jack Pfeffer impersonation and exposed the business, but this time on camera, showing moves, blading, speaking about the evil backstage politics. Honestly, I don't know if you guys watched this. This should have landed Eddie endless training work, because at about 15 minutes, he had this fucking reporter wrestling better than any Ultimate Warrior match.
John, he's dealing with an ear injury at the time.
He's
so
about
like,
to.
Well, we don't know when this was filmed. Was he filmed doing the wrestling training before or after he got slapped? That's the real question. That's what I would do if I was the prosecutor in the case or the defense attorney for old Dr. D. I'm like, well, you're in there bouncing around doing professional wrestling. No problem. And your equilibrium seemed to be fine after Dr. D slapped you. Another one of those things of like, you know what? If I can't make it, I'm going to burn this shit down, which in some aspects I respect and understand on some levels.
Honestly, I'm on Dr. D's side. John Stossel was being an asshole the way he was asking.
He was.
Well, there was like another time where John Stossel almost got like slapped for something else, like in the food and drug industry or something.
Are you really milking these cows?
Dr. D just happened to be the one that we always talk about because we're pro wrestling fans.
That's something that I like about that era of professional wrestler. They would slap somebody if they felt like it. Not all of them did, but at a minor inconvenience, they'd be like, fuck this, I'm a wrestler, just bam!
Yeah, and you know, it kind of gets it out. You know, like it just kind of, like you don't have these big buildups and these huge meltdowns. Like you just slap a dude who deserved it and you move on with your day. You got to do something to get your frustrations out. Slapping John Stossel was one of them for Dr. D. That probably saved somebody's life. Probably ticked Dr. D down so he didn't go murder somebody.
Is this the first instance of violence at a media scrum?
At the media scrum, yes. There's some after a different time.
I believe I laid out a warning a little bit earlier. And it was not heeded. The warning was not heeded. I ask again.
Jake's trying to run a fucking business here, Nick.
Keep the E out your mouth, okay?
I'm sorry you work with children that couldn't manage a target, Jake.
Fucking motherfucker that you were talking to me when you said
Oh,
that.
I was talking about the two of us. That's who I meant.
No.
I swear to God.
Shut your fucking mouth. When you say you can't manage a target, you're also talking about me. Patreon episode one day.
That's a DVD release.
A format not everybody has anymore. That's a good call. Nobody will see it then. Nobody will see it. Good call. Yeah, it's going to be a DVD release.
Not only would this not kill wrestling, WWF and Hulk Hogan were about to launch the sport to the fucking moon, and it just yet again brings up the point, everyone knows it's fake. Watch it because you like it. Then there's the 1987 Bruiser Brody shoot. I wouldn't say he's exposing like the business, that it's like a work or whatever, as much as he's like speaking about the business side of wrestling, booking, producing. And it's just bad shit insane that Bruiser Brody is breaking character and talking like a normal person. It's like the Swedish chef doing Shakespeare. Not the biggest sin we've listed so far, but little peek in.
Yeah, but it makes me appreciate Bruiser that much more. Because I think the reason why this was recorded was it was a friend of Bruiser's whose son was like a journalism major. I think this was a student project. And I think that's why Bruiser was open to do this as a normal person. Like, I think the kid had to interview somebody who was a celebrity, and Bruiser Brody is most certainly that. And yeah, it's really fascinating to see him talk that way. But then I think they get to the part of like, oh, is wrestling fake, and the way he steps around it, but gracefully steps around it, as opposed to just slapping the shit out of him. I remember seeing it, and it made me love Bruiser Brody that much more.
Same.
Because I kind of saw him as like this bully and this guy who just bludgeoned people and take advantage of job guys and was kind of like a one note artist. But then you listen to him talk and you're like, no, there's something calculated going on here. There's something else going on. Something fascinating about this guy. And I'm glad there's many books and documentaries and TV specials that have kind of discussed him a little bit more. He was very fascinating.
It also goes into the hierarchy of respect that was especially around at that time where, you know, if somebody's going to give an interview that even lightly steps around breaking kayfabe and can get away with it, it's going to be somebody way up that totem pole. It's like, you know, if Bruiser wants to go out there and say whatever, that's fine. He could beat the shit out of anybody in the locker room. It's his call. And I think it's, you know, go forward to today. If Undertaker wants to go on Joe Rogan and talk about whatever the fuck he talks about, it's Undertaker.
Also in 87, the Iron Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan were arrested while driving together in the same car in New Jersey. Good old Hacksaw was sauced and driving. The cops bust him, not just for that, but because Hacksaw had weed on him and old Sheiky had that cocaina.
Fucking bullshit!
What overshadowed the DUI and the drug stuff was that the anti-American Sheik and the all-American do-gooder Hacksaw Jim Duggan were riding in the same car as pals.
I don't know how big of a deal this was. To be really quite honest, like I guess if I was like growing up in the Northeast in 87 and it was on every newspaper and local television, I could see you being pissed off about it. But like, I don't know. I think it was two things all at once. If there wasn't drugs involved, if it was a speeding ticket, I feel like we could have got past it. But I think because there's drugs involved, that's why it's such a big deal and it got traction, or why we're like, hey, this is why we got. Can't go forward with his angle on TV, or why Hacksaw will never be that guy because of this. I mean, also, too, this is probably just a few years after Vince had to allegedly slide a briefcase full of money across the table for and tell somebody not to speak English.
Whoa. We don't break kayfabe that far here.
We don't. So, allegedly, he had to do that. So, he's probably in his mind, I'm like, fuck, I gotta trust this Hacksaw guy. I've got Jimmy Snuka money, but I don't have briefcase full of Hacksaw Jim Duggan money. Same for you, Sheiky. I can only carry one briefcase full of money in there. When I got two, now it definitely looks like bribery.
This seems like a weird thing where I don't even know who would have created the narrative for it being like, oh no, this is to protect the business. It really just seems like a corporate PR move to be like, whoa, that's a little too much drugs there. We're trying to get a little more kid friendly. You got to go.
Hacksaw said the cop was like, what are you two doing riding together? We're going to mark ass cop.
It would have been funny if Hacksaw was like, is that who this is? Oh, shit. Shit.
They should have.
And then the cop pulls out his baton and starts whipping the shit out of him. Sheiky baby.
All right. So despite it being let out several times at this point that wrestling is a work, it was still in the 80s very important, at least to people in the actual wrestling industry, to keep kayfabe going. But a rich man having to pay taxes in America? Fuck that. In 1989, Vince McMahon testified before the New Jersey State Senate that wrestling was in fact not a competitive sport, and he did it to avoid taxes that competitive sports have to pay, and I believe insurance reasons as well. This led to it being reported in the New York Times on February 10th, 89, in an article, "Now it can be told, those pro wrestlers are just having fun."
Good, but put it in the newspaper. Let those fucks in Virginia and the Commonwealth tell them to not come after my fucking money. If you want my money, you're going to have to create your own fucking agency, all right? The same for you, South Carolina. You want this Vince McMahon money? Create yourself an athletic commission so you can fucking take it from me. Just goes to show. Wrestlers and wrestling promoters, they will do anything to prevent spending $5 on something at the end of the day. And in Vince's mind, like, you know, if I just say it's fake, they'll leave me alone and I'm a Broadway play. Broadway plays don't get regulated. In his mind, that's how he sees it. Like, I'm making a lot of goddamn money and everybody's sticking their hands in my fucking pockets, especially stupid fucking wrestlers who want these briefcases full of money slid across a fucking table. What do you want me to do?
I'm glad that Vince got what was coming to him.
And that's the other thing that's funny, too, which we'll probably get into next with the steroid trial. It's funny how every time Vince goes on the stand against something heinous like steroids or safety and care of wrestlers.
Consent.
But that's the other thing, too, is like now that he's going through this trail of this, but like all his prior trials of heinous sins, the fucking attorneys want to ask him about whether or not wrestling is real or not. The attorneys get so fucking hung up on like trying to get Vince McMahon to admit that wrestling is real or fake on the stand in the late 80s and 90s that they missed the whole point of like, hey, these fucking wrestlers don't have healthcare and they're a fucking mess. Like, you want to take care of them? I wouldn't be surprised in fucking 2023 an attorney is like, we want to discuss these sexual allegations, but Vince, on the stand, is wrestling real or fake? Like, they'll get so fucking stuck up on the most unimportant bullshit as opposed to the actual fucking sins of the matter.
Another strike to kayfabe's face area was The Undertaker debuting in 1990. I love Undertaker as much as the next guy. In fact, I hated when he tried to be a real human being during the American Badass era. But for fuck's sake, guys, it's a goddamn zombie with magic powers. You think Orange Cassidy is exposing the business? How many times has he been involved in necromancy? You think mean Mark Calloway can do a fucking kip up with his hands in his pockets? No, but he can shoot lightning from the ceiling.
We said this on the Tracy Smothers episode. I think it is such a great story. It should be said again, because every time The Undertaker got brought up around Tracy, he said it. So it's important that we honor his memory by saying the story again. When Tracy Smothers was in the WWF at the time, wrestling as Freddie Joe Floyd, he'd been there like a couple of weeks. And that's when a lot of the other Smoky Mountain guys were coming up, like Tony Anthony as T.L. Hopper. And everybody was in the back watching the monitor. And here's Tony Anthony just trying to make a decent living being a wrestling plumber, because that's what he was asked to do by his employers, and he's going forth and doing the best he possibly can to earn a living as a professional wrestler, as a wrestling plumber. He's sitting there in the ring wrestling, and Undertaker's sitting in the back just looking disgusted, just going, oh, I can't believe we're doing this. This is so awful. This is the most embarrassing thing to professional wrestling, having a gimmick like this. Tracy Smothers, defender of the innocent, goes right to The Undertaker and says, yeah, I know what you mean, Mark. And by the way, how long you been dead? To which Tracy said at that moment, like you could hear a pin drop, and he knew at that moment he was dead. My career was over. That was it. I was done. I was going to be gone. I'm Freddie Joe Floyd forever, and I'm going to be out of here. That's it. 2 weeks, gone.
All right, next up we have the steroid trial. You guys did the steroid trial episode. How did this expose the business?
I mean, these muscles aren't real, so why should we believe the headlocks? Like I said, once again, like the attorneys are like, yeah. Well, talk about your wrestlers, Vince McMahon, doing choreographed violence, huh? As opposed to, hey, why don't you talk about why this package of steroids was delivered right to your office, care of Hulk Hogan? Can you care to elaborate on that, Vince McMahon? Would be an appropriate like question, but no, you want to spend 20 minutes in your cross-examination to talk about fucking whether or not wrestling is real or fake, as opposed to why these wrestlers feel like they have to inject themselves full of steroids to make it a continual living.
They have to do everything I tell them to do, but they're independent contractors. They're completely independent in thought. I had no influence over them whatsoever, but they better do what I tell them.
Much like this attorney, he's getting a 1099 as well.
All right, so forget everything we've talked about so far. May 19th, 1996, at Madison Square Garden, kayfabe would be exposed for literally the first time. Old timers, get ready to clutch your pearls. This was the night that Razor Ramon, real name Scott Hall, mind you, and Diesel, who was not an actual truck, would work with WWF before heading to WCW. That night, in the main event, Shawn Michaels, who is actually a sexy man, not a sexy boy, wrestled Diesel in the main event. HBK's theme song is the soundtrack to a priest's love story. All right, sorry.
Fine. I'll allow it. I'm a click defender, and I'll allow it. It's weird. Don't get me wrong. Like when I won a prize at the carnival and I asked for the picture of Shawn Michaels, the guy who is working the carnival like balloon toss thing, had a lot of questions about this young man in small town Iowa and how he was going to deal with the ridicule that he was going to face in his life because he wanted this picture, a shirtless Shawn Michaels dressed as a male stripper.
Sure. Is this the one with the winged eagle belt over his dick? I hope it's that one.
No. That was before he ever won the title. This was like that mid-90s when he first did the whole like white leather thing with the chain running across his chest.
The real sexy one, I gotcha.
Sunglasses pulled down like, ooh, don't you want some of this? Mm. And everybody was like, no, but can you go out and have an awesome match?
After HBK meets Diesel, real-life friends, Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Triple H hugged in the ring. Only some of them were good guys, and some of them were bad. Any thoughts on the curtain call?
It seemed like you were going to continue on with some other point, but we were going to let you be. But no, here's the thing. I think here's always the point of kayfabe is dead, but let's not beat it over people's heads.
Yeah.
Kind of the unwritten rule now, like, hey, when we're at the show, this is what we do. Let's not sit at the merch table and make jokes when we're feuding against each other. Like, there's still a little bit of that, and that's fine. We can be in the same row of merch, but, like, let's not be together. And that's kind of the hard and fast rule. When people walk through the doors, let's pretend like we hate each other. Even if you're a heel and you're selling merch, like, still be a heel. Still have some sort of, like, you know, sense of immersion. Like, you can do a lot of things as a heel at a gimmick table and still make merch and still be a bad guy and still be somebody that people boo and hate and not like and still make money. It's still possible. Just don't pull back the curtain like, I'm actually a nice guy, buy my t-shirt. But what they did in the curtain call, we see this every goddamn fucking match. Yep. Now,
yeah,
there's nothing I fucking hate more than, hey, we just had this 5-star match, let's shake fucking hands. And they fucking do. I fucking hate that. Leave a little fucking heat, tell somebody fuck off, or just roll the fuck out the ring, or take your victory and tell that guy to get the fuck out of the ring. I fucking hate it after every, like, we had a banger of a match, let's shake hands. Because this promoter, all he wanted to do is book dream match after dream match after dream match after dream match. So then it's like just fucking 8 matches of guys doing all their fucking spots and then all of them shaking hands fucking afterwards. I dare somebody just walk out there, be a good guy, be a bad guy, and then when you leave, you feel bad for this guy, you feel good for this guy, you hate this motherfucker, you feel satisfied that this guy got his ass kicked. Can't we fucking do that? Is that so fucking wrong? You know what? Kayfabe is fucking dead because nobody wants to book characters that are good guys, bad guys anymore. That's why it's fucking dead, okay? That's why kayfabe is dead, because nobody's telling stories of good guy versus bad guy. That's why it's fucking dead.
Jake, not a fan of the Ring of Honor code of conduct there. No handshaking allowed in his matches.
But here's the thing. You fucking can be. There can be a fucking story about it in the sense that this guy doesn't shake hands. Because that was always the deal too, is there'd be this one guy who doesn't shake hands. I, as a fucking job guy, jumped Jerry Lynn in the code of honor. I was wrestling Jerry Lynn at a Ring of Honor TV taping, and he said, you know, when you do the code of honor, kick me in the stomach. I'm a fucking nobody. I'm supposed to do a job for you, and you want me to, like, get heat off the code of conduct right away. Like, he did a favor for me immediately. I'm established as a fucking bad guy immediately. Had a great fucking match with him, and yeah, you can use the code of conduct. There's things you could do with it in storytelling. But who gives a fuck? Nobody's doing that. They just shake their goddamn hand and move the fuck on.
With today's wrestling fan, is there even a place for a true heel anymore?
You don't need a true heel. You just need a guy that you don't want to see win. Nobody walking into an AEW event wants to see QT Marshall win a match.
Okay.
But when he fucking wins, you're fucking mad. You know what I'm saying? And then when he's wrestling somebody who's a fan favorite and he gets his ass beat. Like, imagine QT Marshall, like, goes on this insane win streak. Insane fucking win streak. And talks about how much of a badass he is. And then Miro shows up and leaves that motherfucker bloody. How fucking over does Miro get all of a sudden? Like, here's this guy talking all this shit, and people are like, get QT off our TV, get QT off our TV, and Miro's the one who fucking does it. All of a sudden, don't you love Miro that much more? Because he got rid of the guy that you didn't want on your television. Same reason why Miz is still as popular. You put the Miz against anybody, it fucking works.
Are you telling me QT Marshall is AEW's top true heel?
In some aspects, yes.
Okay. God forbid we speak his name aloud, he who shall not be named. Was it Punk before something happened a couple weeks ago?
He wasn't booked as such.
Fuck no, he wasn't.
That's the difference.
And I don't think he thought he was.
We won't even get into the levels of whatever was going on there. I disagree, to say the least.
The only reason I bring it up is because, like, the people who started to dislike him, it was like the first time there was real heat on somebody at that level in a long time, it felt like.
He was getting a reaction, and what you do with that reaction But when you're getting screwed by Ricky Starks and you want to make a comeback and you're making a save on Ricky Steamboat, are you a heel?
I wish most of the heat surrounding him was related to what was going on in the ring.
Yep, I wish so too. Boy, we can make money on that.
Yeah. It's a weird thing talking about kayfabe because it's like when wrestling first started, it was about trying to get that true, actual, visceral feeling from fans as a heel. And fast forward to 2023, I had it for somebody, and it's not really fun anymore. It's weird. It's morphed so much into, like, I don't want to actually hate anybody. I hate him to the point it was like, I don't want you on this program that I enjoy.
But that's the problem. People are like, oh, you're bringing it down. You're bringing the work rate around. I don't like seeing your matches. But like I said, if there is a payoff for this guy taking up space in your fucking life to being taken out of your life by somebody who now you like because he was the guy that did that, that's where we're missing it. What ends up happening is like, oh, this guy's, he's on television. Twitter's saying he shouldn't be on our television program. And they don't like that he's on his television program, so let's just get him off. When in actuality, you could use that hatred and that visceral dislike to make somebody now be liked and put into that particular place.
This switch happened with John Cena, and it was continued with early days Roman Reigns. John Cena was the greatest heel of the 2010s, and he got this dual benefit from it because he was such a squeaky clean face. He still sold all the merch to the kids. And the more he was a squeaky clean face, the more the fucking crowd hated him. So anyone who went up against Cena, immediately over as fuck. You immediately rooted for them. Same thing with Roman Reigns during his up and coming run.
But they've booked Roman as a heel. They never booked Cena as a heel and capitalized anybody to use that to get over. They never booked it as such so they never capitalize on it and they never use it as a vehicle to get anybody else over. People had great matches then were viewed as stars when you wrestled Cena, but there was never this aspect of like, oh, now this guy's the biggest babyface because he beat Cena.
Right.
That made you hate him fucking more. You know how much I hate it, like Super Cena era? I've never hated an actual heel that much, not since I was like a little kid.
But Nick, they never let us come. That's the problem. Like they built it up over and over and over as Super Cena, Super Cena, Super Cena. And then he's like, going to Hollywood. And now he pops back in and does jobs or wins or whatever the fuck he does when he's coming back in on a part-time basis now. And I think they left a lot of money on the table. And God fucking forbid, at WrestleMania 68 or whatever the fuck it is, and Cena comes in, he finally turns heel when he's old and gray to wrestle Goldberg's corpse. Wow, really pulled the trigger at the right time, Vince.
But the thing is, the second Cena turns heel, he'll be the biggest face to wrestling fans. It's backwards now, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm.
Squeaky clean faces, white meat, cheesy as fuck faces, are now heels, and the cool bad guy are now the biggest faces on the planet. I guess Stone Cold and The Rock started that, but it was like Cena who really did that role reversal officially, I think. And some of that was maybe dumb luck or whatever, and sure, WWE's awful at times. But you have some of the greatest minds in wrestling there. You think they didn't fucking recognize that? That every time they booked Cena against Jon Moxley, who we all loved or whatever the fuck, that Mox wasn't getting his balls cheered off, even though he was a heel with a shield or whatever, or Seth Rollins or whoever it was. And Cena, the squeaky clean good guy, was getting booed out of every fucking arena he ever stepped. They just switched it. And that was like their way to work us. So then we get to the Montreal Screwjob. This is actually a work and an ideal example of kayfabe, so let's move on. 1998, Road Wild and Jay Leno wrestling. Celebrities have done random spots to this point. Known athletes like Ernie Ladd have become great pro wrestlers. Refrigerator Perry had popped in. Lawrence Taylor headlined a WrestleMania. Muhammad Ali and Tyson had done stuff, which is super believable. Dennis Rodman, Karl Malone, I can buy that. They're pro athletes. But Jay Leno. First of all, I know stand-up comedians. They're pussies. That's why they learn to use their words. For Jay Leno to not leave this match with every bone in his body shattered into dust is so egregious that anyone who didn't immediately boycott the industry forever has no room to comment on anything looking fake ever. Like, this is kayfabe's greatest champion since Bruno Sammartino, Hulk Hogan, getting put into holds by a late-night talk show host. Tyler, have you seen this? Have you heard about this?
Oh, you son of a bitch. You stepped on my joke.
You seen this? You heard about this? It's called a snapmare.
Yeah, I've seen clips from it, and wow, Jay really got dressed up for the part. He really looks like a wrestler. He really gave it his all, I guess.
Yeah, and from what I heard, like what Jay wanted to do was not only main event the pay-per-view, he also wanted to come on half an hour before the pay-per-view as well, too, to kind of undermine the rest of the pay-per-view, much like Conan. So because this is a pro-Conan podcast, and he still should have been the host of The Tonight Show and had been given a better shot. So this is a pro-Conan podcast, as all podcasts are.
Also in 1998, we got Exposed, Pro Wrestling's Greatest Secrets, that aired November 1st, 1988 on NBC.
I remember watching this. I remember this is appointment viewing for me. And at this moment in time, it's like, who gives a fuck? If anything, I use this more as a training video. Like, oh, is that how you do it? Okay, and then start doing it with my friends. That's how far we have come in 1998, is no longer are these expose videos like, oh my God, this is the most shocking thing ever. It's like, oh, that's how you do it? Okay, cool. Now I can actually start wrestling by watching this expose video and teach myself how to become a pro wrestler.
This was it for me. This was 11-year-old little Nicholas. I had heard the rumblings, the little whispers that pro wrestling wasn't real, and I chose to ignore them. Little baby me saw this coming on, and I thought, I'll learn some cool unknown facts about wrestling, some wrestling secrets, like what kind of car Macho Man drives. 45 minutes later, jaw dropped, I believe in tears. This show destroyed any amount of faith I would ever have in humanity, as it revealed that wrestling was indeed scripted. And you know what happened, though? I watched Raw the next time it was on. So
damn right you did.
Well, I also couldn't, like, show Bret Hart versus the British Bulldog in a bloodbath and get my buddy to believe it after Harley Race is sitting there incognito telling everybody that wrestling is fake. So this definitely ruined my whole argument with Mike Osmacher.
I came into wrestling knowing that it wasn't real, but not knowing the actual mechanics, and having them break it down the way that they did, like, it's ingrained in my mind. The close-up on the guy's hand where they're like, how do they punch people? And it doesn't hurt them. And then he opens it up like this. And I'm like, that blew my fucking mind.
I wish fucking wrestling students would watch that. Because goddamn motherfuckers are punching me full on closed fists with stiff fucking punches. I dare them watch this thing as a training
video.
They
watch the Japanese version of Exposed Pro Wrestling's Greatest Secrets.
No, fucking, they just haul off and fucking hit people. And then the wrestling trainer's like, good, go out there and wrestle now.
You know how you explain it to them? You fucking haul back and give them a receipt, brother. They won't forget. Going into 2004, April 15th, to be specific, this is one of my times where, you know, I knew wrestling wasn't real. I was about a year into watching at the time. And I was like, but this thing might have been real. It was when Big Show chokeslammed Kurt Angle off of the three-story ledge on SmackDown. Kurt was the GM at the time, and I was like, well, obviously there's a crash pad or something, and the camera looks down. No, it's Kurt Angle, and they've put, like, fake blood around the back of his head. And I'm like, how old? I'm 10 years old at the time, and I'm, like, losing my fucking mind that Kurt Angle cracked his head open from a two-story fall, and he's dead. The man's fucking dead.
With the multi-camera angle fucking shoot, you couldn't be like, oh, this is clearly fake.
I was 10 years old. Also, in April of 2004, this could be argued as exposing kayfabe, killing it, or possibly protecting it. One of my favorite wrestling matches turned shoot fights, New Jack versus Gypsy Joe.
Okay, that was a very real incident that fucking happened.
When we said the thing about the baseball bat earlier, I was like, oh boy, yes, something else coming up with a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm.
2005, November 2005, once again another death rattle in pro wrestling, and it's kind of, next two things are kind of rolled into one that they kind of start, they're the foundation for Botchamania, and Botchamania, I feel like, brought something new to wrestling that it didn't have, and it was like the precursor to like memes and whatever, but it was a place for younger people who love wrestling in spite of all the weirdness and all the flaws to come together. First clip was It's Still Real to Me, Damn It, from November 2005. The wrestling, whatever god-awful wrestling reunion type of deal they had at a gymnasium.
Tribute to Starrcade, motherfucker. And it was at the Spartanburg Memorial Auditorium where you saw many, many classic mashups from Jim Crockett Promotions. And it was a High Spots Productions, which actually that clip of It's Still Real to Me almost didn't see the light of day because I thought the more interesting thing in that Q&A session with the Midnight Express and I believe Terry Funk was when somebody was talking about Dusty cutting the ticket prices because the houses were so bad because of his bad booking. Dusty Rhodes came out of the fucking locker room, which he was just an earshot of somebody talking shit to him. And a young Cody Rhodes was in the back as well, too, during this event. See, he left his son, Cody. I'm like, hold on, young Cody. Let me show you how you deal with shit. Gets out there, grabs a microphone, and proceeds to go, listen here, boy. There was no $2 tickets in my day. No, people paid high dollar to get into Jim Crockett Promotions when I was booking it. So tell you what, once you get in your truck and drive off into West Virginia. Like, I thought that was the fucking clip that was going to sell this DVD. Little did I know that It's Still Real to Me guy would be taking bookings and then said that he never made a dime off of that. He gets bookings all the time. He's now famous. That's what you do with fame, is you make money off of it. And we made you famous. And I think I even said as much. And the words go fuck yourself may have ended that sentence as well.
So the next blow to kayfabe was on June 11th, 2007, an episode of Monday Night Raw, when Vince McMahon entered a limousine outside of the arena and it blew the fuck up. While a lot of people thought, possibly hoped, it was real, in fact, it was just another one of pro wrestling's blatant lies that at first had earned kayfabe another spot with the company. They had people going there for a minute. But then less than 2 weeks later, you know who did you know what. And Vince is back on TV, undead, revealing it was just a story and we don't care about concussions.
So I was in seventh grade when this happened, and I gave it more thought than I should have, to be completely honest. It was very good camera work. Also, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think WWE like posted on WWE.com, Vince McMahon dead. As you saw in the Raw overtime at 11:13 last night, Vince McMahon stared at Paul London, got into his limo, and exploded.
Apparently, Paul London got fired here. This is, mm-hmm. He like laughed, and that's why he got fired. That's fucked up.
He wasn't laughing, well, he was cheesing, but that also fits Paul London.
There was a lot of things going on with Paul at that time that they could have fired him for, probably. But yeah, but this game cause. I remember people buying it, people actually thinking he was dead. Like, oh, I think he really died. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it's especially at this time, like at this fucking time. Really? Really? After everything you've fucking seen on television, you thought that was real. And I'll never forget somebody like went backstage at WWE, like that I was with. They were, their father worked for the company and got us tickets. And he came to the back and he goes, hey, you know, Vince isn't dead. He's back there getting a haircut right now. It's like, yeah, no shit. I bet he's fucking there. No fucking shit. No fucking shit. I do wish he who shall not be mentioned wouldn't have done what he did, because I kind of want to see where we were going to go. Like, what was Vince going to do? What crazy batshit thing was he going to do? I do love that at Fan Access for WrestleMania, they had the exploding limo on display. they kept that for a museum someday. So whatever, they have a physical, actual museum. Look forward to seeing that.
I have a little thing I would like to share with you guys. This is probably the final nail in the coffin for kayfabe for me. When I was a young man, I was about, I think, 16, 17, somewhere in there. And it was October 23rd, 2010. Jake, do you know where you were?
Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Jacksonville, North Carolina. Who were you teaming with?
Oh, I was teaming with Joey Sylvia.
Yep.
Taking on Paul London and El Generico.
El Generico, that's right. I still am the biggest El Generico fan. He is my number one wrestler of all time. The love that I had for the El Generico character in 2010 was second to none. He was an inspiration to me, fantastic wrestler. His inability to speak English or Spanish but still cut an amazing promo just shows how great of a performer he is. And I show up to the Civic Center in Jacksonville, North Carolina. I'm so excited. I'm going to meet my favorite wrestler. If anyone is a listener of the now defunct Stranger in a Southern Land podcast, you've already heard this story.
Very defunct.
Yes.
Stranger in a Southern Land podcast.
So I, at three separate points that evening, went up to El Generico. I bought a support mask and a t-shirt that I still have. And
when people, well, certain people would call harass, but
was showing my adoration.
Okay, harass. Okay, could be another thing.
You can't be a white French Canadian dude dressing up like a luchador and not expect to get some weirdos coming by. All right, that's the it's the price you pay.
Especially, there you go.
So I go over. I get one picture. I think with just me and like the mask and Paul London and El Generico. They're on either side of me. I'm holding the mask. And then I decided, I got to go back. I want to get one in the mask. And I put this mask on. I had just laced it up. I had just bought it from the wonderful folks at highspots.com. And I had laced up the back of it. Didn't do it all the way because I am a shy kid, a whole bunch of hair trying to hide my face. Just very shy. And I go to put the mask on. I didn't get the laces out of the way. And one of them pokes right through the eye hole. I'm too nervous to fix it, and I go up to El Generico, and I go, picture? One word. Don't want to confuse him. His English isn't good. And he looks at me, he goes, one moment, and he kind of, like, reaches out towards the one that's sticking out of the eye hole of the mask, and I go, don't you mean un momento? And he goes, yeah. And then he turns, we take the picture, and I walk away. And that's the day that kayfabe 100% died for me.
And that was definitely a day where he walked to the back and then started bitching about this fucking weird-looking fan, corrected him for not speaking Spanish, when he looked like a moron with a lace mask string sticking out his eye hole, and out of the kind of his heart, he didn't want you to look stupid in this photo that you waited for after you're back again to harass this man when he's just trying to make a living so he could help those poor kids in an orphanage in Tijuana, and then here you are. You know, looking all like a moron. He's trying to fix it, make you feel better so you don't feel bad about this picture that's going to live on in infamy. And you make him feel like shit. So, congratulations. That is the equivalent of fans stabbing you on the way back from the ring. Okay? Like, that is what fans do now. They make you feel stupid, and what you're doing is dumb and make you question your life. No longer are there stabbings, so yes, we are all soft, but emotionally we get hurt just the same, and the scars are very real.
Muy estupido, sí.
All right, from kayfabe dying for Tyler to kayfabe dying for everyone. Kayfabe put up a good fight, but at well over 100 years old, depending on when you start your pro wrestling history lineage, at a fragile, weakened state, kayfabe had no more fight in it. This led to December 27th, 2019 at Pro Wrestling Revolver's Nightmare at Xmas, where kayfabe would be found dead. In what all call an act of domestic terrorism, one Man Scout Jake Manning picked up an actual camping tent, suffocated kayfabe to death with it, and then wrestled it. Two questions, Jake. Do you recall how maniacally you laughed at kayfabe's muffled screams, and what do you have to say for yourself?
I find it hilarious that you think that this killed kayfabe. If anything, I have talked about Tent as if it's its own entity. Tent and I have a serious feud together, and you don't see us together. You don't see us riding around together like you would see the Iron Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. No. And Tent has a completely separate Twitter account that has its own views that I do not condone, and I've gone out on record many a time saying that Tent is the worst person ever. There's been a true hatred, the long-standing feud that, you know, you don't see me and Tent out back going over our spots. We meet each other in the ring to have matches as competitors. So if anything, me and Tent are the ultimate of kayfabe. We're not doing shoot interviews saying, oh, man, we worked all those marks out there. No, me and Tent actually hate each other. So if anything, I'm keeping kayfabe more so than all these other old timers, especially these old timers like Al Snow, who cannot see the irony that basically my interactions with Tent is no different than him and Head. As a matter of fact, dream matches of mine would be Al Snow and Head versus me and Tent. But he done flushed that down the toilet. That was a million-dollar booking idea because he doesn't understand what the fuck Tent is. But somehow we all know what a mannequin head is.
Do you want us to clip that and tag him in it, or do you want us to cut it like the Chris Jericho line from earlier?
No, I actually could probably keep the Chris Jericho because he's never going to listen to this. Besides, we all know as Al is a wonderful subscriber and a Patreon member. So, Al, if you got any suggestions for any Patreon episodes, let us know. Let us know. Any drunk history you want Tyler? See, that's what Al's favorites are, is when Tyler gets drunk and completely fucks up wrestling history. Those are Al Snow's favorite episodes, as we all know.
Hey, he knows what everybody wants. Head.
Yes, we got it. Got it. Cool.
All right, so final thoughts on kayfabe.
I never knew kayfabe. The wrestling I grew up on is a mix of tongue-in-cheek and outright spitting in the face of kayfabe. That's what I liked about it. I don't want to completely kill the wink-wink nudge-nudge, but one of my favorite wrestlers growing up, the thing was, that's not who they are. That's not the character they're playing. They're obviously somebody else, and that's what I loved about it. And yeah. I think that's a new thing that you find with the newer generation of wrestlers and wrestling fans. They don't hold kayfabe in the same level of reverence that they used to, but they know that it's a basic building block for the storytelling. But it's not essential for the wrestling business to live that kayfabe be maintained. And I'm glad that it's shifted that way now.
Kayfabe has always been more important to wrestlers and the people in the wrestling industry more than it ever was to fans. And like, I appreciate it. When you help us feel for these wrestlers and these stories, it's the best thing. But we've all cried during a movie or felt anger during a show or triple checked that our doors were locked after a horror. And it's been proven time and time again for literally 100 years that us marks, we don't need it to be real. Just don't give us blatant spoilers. And obviously there has to be some semblance of realism and structure, but I think things have 180'd. Like, to believe kayfabe is even still possible. To think that there's any reason to protect the business or that wrestler A makes this more legit than wrestler B makes you one of the last remaining true marks on the face of the planet. But, like, is it just acknowledging the fact that it is entertainment more meaningful? Like, give wrestlers credit for their acting, athleticism, mic skills, acknowledge the pain they endure for their art, the amazing ability to perform these stunts in one go in front of a live crowd. When, as Jake mentioned, some Hollywood bitch boy gets more mainstream love and respect for having CGI and set design and stunt doubles and crash pads and 53 takes and editing. Isn't acknowledging that just more impressive than pretending wrestlers are like a fake tough person with a belt? Like, wrestlers are so gifted at what they do that to an extent, in that moment, we choose to believe it. Like, when we meet a wrestler, we know we're meeting Triple H or Kenny Omega or Buff Bagwell, not Paul, not Tyson, not the American males. And acknowledging that is like where the last bit of magic lives. Because the only thing that has ever been real in pro wrestling is making people care about these characters and performers. And as long as people are achieving that and fans are still watching, still buying tickets, still buying merch, shut the fuck up.
I went on a rant earlier, and just to kind of, you know, bring it back up again. You know, kayfabe is dead because nobody wants to tell stories anymore. What's the point of making an immersive, realistic story that bleeds out into reality when nobody wants to tell stories anymore? Everybody just wants to book dream matches. And that killed kayfabe more than any of the things we've listed today. Nobody wants to book a compelling story. Like I said, if anything, my feud with a camping tent has kept the tradition going further, more so of kayfabe than anything else, of a good guy fighting a bad guy. That's gone. Nobody wants to book that anymore. There's numerous compelling stories that I could even tell with myself. For example, me and Dax Hardwood, we've never really liked each other to the point that our friends don't know if we hate each other. or like each other secretly. There's that doubt nobody really knows. If we were to ever be booked in a indie show against each other and we were just given a live microphone and went at each other, you wouldn't be able to tell if our hatred was real, fake, or not. But we are professional enough that you'll never know. And in a sense, we'll never show you, nor will we show each other that we're not working. Those compelling stories could be told all the time. By me, by multiple different people, but with egos, with money, with nobody interested in sticking around to the end of a story. Nobody sticking around to feel uncomfortable in a story. For nobody wanting to follow along and let, like, oh, the bad guy won. We're going to shut this off. We're going to watch something else. And then people going, oh my God, they changed the channel because they didn't get what they want right away. Well, we can't have the bad guy win or do anything to make anybody feel weird or uncomfortable. No, we can't do that. Or we just got to give everybody dream matches, and everybody's got to be happy, 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 happy. Kayfabe is dead because nobody wants to tell a story anymore. That's what essentially killed it, more so than anything we've listed today. Nobody wants to tell stories. Nobody has enough thought process. Nobody has enough commitment. Nobody has enough patience to watch. So between the fans and the promoters, it's dead. So, who gives a fuck?
All right, that is Kayfabe's 10 Bell Pod. Thanks for listening. Check out our pro wrestling t-shirt, our Patreon, our social media at 10 Bell Pod. Tyler, Jacob.
As always, guys, leave a review on whatever platform you're listening on. It truly helps the show. And go buy a shirt on Pro Wrestling Tees. Let's go make them work and put some more Jake Manning faces on some t-shirts to really piss old Frank off in there. See, I know people that work at Pro Wrestling Tees. How about that? So let's all make Frank mad.
Yeah, if you guys want to tell us what you'd like to hear in the Patreon exclusive episodes, I think we have a trivia battle brewing at the moment between me and Jake. Wonder who's going to win. if you guys also want to go over to shopaew.com and pick up a Fear the Revolt FTR t-shirt, someone who Jake might be secretly friends with, give them a little bit of money also so he can buy more coffee and tell horrible stories on his podcast. And other than that, we will catch you guys later.
God damn it, you took my sign-off line again.
I don't know if it helps or hurts.
Honestly, it helps. If you want to start being the sign-off line guy, you're more than welcome.
Okay. Nah, this shit's not real, man.